For Illinois Newsroom, I'm Jim Meadows, and here's an interview with Stephanie Smith of Urbana. She's a first-time candidate running for the Democratic nomination in Illinois' 13th Congressional District, where Republican Rodney Davis is the incumbent. The recording date was January 29th, which, as you'll hear noted in the interview, was the day that President Trump signed a bill implementing the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement. Stephanie Smith, what do you like to tell voters about yourself, and why are you running for Congress?
Well, my name is Stephanie Smith. I'm working class. I don't have a background in politics in terms of running for office. This is my first time ever running for office. The main reason that I'm running is that the issues that I feel are really, really important to me, the people that I love, and my community haven't made it to the discussions in a meaningful way, in my opinion. And I believe that the people most affected by policies should be the people driving those policies. So that's what has inspired me to run.
Why have you decided to challenge Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan for the Democratic nomination, you know, given the support that she's been able to attract?
It has nothing to do with her. It has to do with the fact that the primaries are the time when we should be talking about the issues that are more important to the community at large, that we should be bringing in more voices, that we should really be assessing the realities of our district and what our needs are, and we should be strategizing on how to get those needs met. And historically in politics, I feel like politicians have always told me what I need instead of asking me what I need. And so the reason that I'm running is to sort of be an antithesis to that. And that's how I wound up in the primary.
What sort of issues are you seeing that you don't think are being brought up, you don't think are being addressed?
Healthcare is going to be a really, really big issue, I think, especially in this district, because this is a very impoverished district. Over the summer, 60% of the district was eligible for SNAP. Now they've changed the requirements for it, so less of the district, I believe, is eligible, but still just as poor. And a large percentage of our district is heavily rent burdened. I don't see candidates talking about those issues. Low wage work, you know, we can talk about unemployment being low, but if the jobs aren't paying for rent, groceries, and medication, if it's not enough to cover those things, then it doesn't mean anything to people like me, you know. Those are probably the issues that I feel are most relevant to the district and the people that I've been engaging with.
You mentioned healthcare, and you've voiced support for a healthcare system that would amount to Medicare for all, something that would essentially—
Yes. Single payer.
A single payer, something that would do away with private health insurance as we've known it. Mm-hmm. Why is that important, and why does, say, the public option approach, for instance, not work for you?
Yeah, it's important because I'm not into dying. As somebody with chronic illness, and I have private insurance, I still can't cover all of the copays for the specialists. And frequently, there are medications that aren't covered under insurance. It becomes very, very taxing. There are so many people who are uninsured, and that's a big problem. But even the people who are insured are going bankrupt when they get cancer diagnoses and try to get treatment. You know, that's not a working system. And when we have a system that is that broken, people put off healthcare until they're in emergency situations. And then we find our emergency services overloaded. You know, this has repercussions for all sorts of things, including disaster response or if there's large storms, that sort of thing. So we're really burdening our system in a very, very unhealthy way and keeping people from accessing the care that they need, even through private insurance.
You know, as a reporter, I get emails from a Republican group answering back every time the other primary candidate, Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan, does something. They regularly refer to her as a socialist. For them, that is about the worst thing that they could say about a candidate. You have support from Democratic Socialist groups in the 13th District, and you're a founding member of the Rose Caucus, which is a group that identifies itself as socialist. So I'm wondering, what does that mean in practical terms of the sort of lawmaker you'd be and the sort of goals you had if you were elected?
Yeah. For me, I consider myself very much like disenfranchised working class when it comes to the political system. I consider queer a political identity for me. So I support socialist policies. I think that the DSA is doing amazing work locally organizing.
That's Democratic Socialists of America?
Yes. Yeah. They're organizing around a lot of the issues that I've been talking about to you. And I feel very strongly that they've kind of struck a nerve in that regard in terms of getting people engaged based on issues. I think that that's really important because then it doesn't require you to put an entire political ideology or party above the needs of the people. So for me, when I hear things about socialism in like a scary sort of way, it's usually rooted in propaganda because if you look at the policies that we're talking about supporting, they're populist. You know, they're overwhelmingly supported by people from a variety of different backgrounds. And so to me, I'm not upset when people call me a socialist, but I don't necessarily identify as a socialist myself, but I absolutely support socialist policies.
If you're the Democratic nominee, you'd be running against a Republican incumbent, Rodney Davis, who would, I would guess, point to what he sees as a strong economy. I know unemployment in Illinois last month was 3.7%. That's the lowest since they started keeping numbers the way they do now. Does that accurately reflect conditions in the 13th District? How is the economy that it needs the changes that you say it needs?
It has to do with quality of life, right? Like statistics and numbers about unemployment rates don't necessarily reflect the reality of who is actually unemployed or underemployed. You know, people trying to get disability benefits, for example, aren't included in unemployment numbers, as far as I know, but they are not working, right? And it takes years to get disability. So I feel like oftentimes we see politicians use numbers about the economy to suggest that there has been improved quality of life. But when we look at the numbers on rent burden and food insecurity, healthcare costs, we see that that doesn't really translate into improved resources or a better life for us. So I feel very, very skeptical when people tell me numbers that say things are going well, and then I speak to people and they're like, I can't feed my children.
The concerns you have, do they have an application to the farming sector of the 13th District, with agriculture being the big part of the economy that it is in the 13th District? What are your priorities for farmers?
I'm very, very worried because farming here has historically been a really robust industry, and it's provided a lot of jobs and resources, and we're seeing small farmers being pushed out. The bailouts went to large farms. You know,
the bailouts as
Trump's bailout.
To counterbalance the tariffs in the trade dispute with China.
Yes, yes, those bailouts. So my understanding is that those hadn't provided much relief for people in our district, like the everyday sort of person. And I also know that I've spoken with a lot of people in Decatur, and they're having a hard time. They're getting a lot of pushback on things like the hemp industry, like industrial hemp for paper products, or you can use it for a variety of materials, and it's considered a much more sustainable sort of crop, and they really need industry there. And they're not getting any help or support from Representative Davis, and he sits on the Hemp Council with Mitch McConnell, who owns a bunch of hemp farms in Kentucky. So I would love to hear from more farmers about the sort of policies that they believe would actually help them. And I want to hear that directly from the farmers, not from people like Rodney Davis speaking on behalf of them.
President Trump signed an implementation bill today for the the USMCA, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement, the updating of NAFTA, one of President Trump's big campaign promises. This is a treaty that's supposed to help level the playing field between the U.S. and its two nearest neighbors, and it won enough Democratic support to pass Congress. Does it go in the direction you favor?
I am going to be honest with you that I try really, really hard to actually read all of the policies that I talk about myself, and I have not had a chance to read that. And so I don't feel comfortable giving a comment on that because I would rather reserve my judgment until I can have a fully formed opinion.
Do you have any goals or philosophies that you'd want to apply in terms of trade relations between the U.S. and other countries, if not on the specifics of this treaty, just the way that trade goes forward with the U.S. and other parts of the world?
There are so many people that have been working on this issue that are better informed about these issues that I feel like should be involved in this process. And I'm hoping to get a better education on these things because, like I said, my background's not in politics. There are issues with global trade that I find very, very concerning that other people aren't speaking about. Like the garment industry is incredibly tied to slave labor. And it's also very, very much tied to sex trafficking. And a lot of people don't understand how those ties work, that there are a lot of non-governmental organizations, NGOs, that actively basically pull people from the sex trade and then put them in sweatshops. And that is a large part of the global economy. And I never hear people talking about those sort of issues when it comes to trade deals. And so that is an area that I would like to see more discussion around and what I would hope to bring to the table personally in dealing with these things. I really, really believe that we need to look at trade as something that is mutually beneficial, and I think that we need to kind of drop the exploitative imperialist aspect of it that we have.
And as you go forward with your campaign, how do you get your message across to people who aren't already on your wavelength, given the partisan divide that a lot of people see in the nation as a whole?
Yeah, this is such a tricky thing because I think anytime that somebody takes a bold stand for something that they believe in, it's going to be polarizing and divisive for people in this political climate. But for me, I want people to understand that regardless of whether or not they agree with me or disagree with me, my point is that we all have a place in this process. We all have a voice. We should all be bringing our ideas to the table. Like, this isn't about me saving the world. That's ridiculous. You know, so many politicians make promises that they can't fulfill. Like, this has to be a collaborative effort. We are facing immense catastrophes on a global scale, and they have local implications. And I really, really want people to get more involved in civics on every level. And so I'm really trying to foster an environment where people can ask questions and know that they're going to get like a real answer. And hopefully that helps them feel like they can safely engage in politics without just being shouted down and it turning into a fight.
The final question, tell me about an issue that you care about, that it's something that you want to pursue in your campaign and would in Congress if elected.
Absolutely. SESTA FOSTA, that's the Stop Enabling Sex Trafficking Act.
And I understand these were laws that were passed recently that are meant to curb sex trafficking online.
Yeah, so they got bipartisan support, signed into law by Donald Trump. And what happened with it is that it weakened the Communications Decency Act, Section 230, which basically now they're saying Section 230 used to say that a platform wasn't responsible for what somebody using the platform said or did, right? So like Facebook wouldn't be responsible for what I said. But now Facebook is responsible for what I say, potentially, under this new law, which is why Backpage and Craigslist and a bunch of other websites went down, because if somebody was trying to sell sex or solicit sex on there, then they would be held responsible for that and could be tried in a federal court under trafficking laws. The real world metaphor that I kind of like to use is imagine a library with all of the books inside. And if there's a line in a book that is criminal, imagine the library being punished for that.
Would it be similar to say that in the previous sense, an outfit like Facebook was seen as like the phone company? They're just delivering messages. And
yes.
Now they seem a little bit like the publisher.
Right. Yes, exactly. So it weakens that protection. But the reason that it's been so dangerous is that it has suppressed harm reduction materials being exchanged. It's gotten rid of the ability for people to screen clients or talk about bad experiences.
You're talking about among sex workers?
It started there, but it actually, we're seeing blanket censorship, a chilling effect from this legislation, because they're not sure what would qualify as something that could get them in trouble. So we're seeing a lot of content, especially LGBTQ content, being censored. We're seeing public health content, like around HIV drugs, being censored. We're seeing bodily health stuff, like medical manuals about bodies, being censored. So it's actually become far more wide-reaching.
So you're seeing this law is doing more harm than good?
Yes. So it's actually made it more difficult to find sex traffickers, because they've been pushed underground and now they're no longer using the websites, even, which had been working with law enforcement to get these traffickers. So it has failed to protect the people that it said it would, and it has really become nothing but a censorship bill.
Do you think the law can be salvaged or changed in some way, or would you just want to do away with it?
So, you know how most bills are about as thick as an entire binder with a lot of stuff added in, like addendums, and this bill is like one page, and that's all it does. So I don't think it can be salvaged, because this is the bill, is just the weakening of Section 230. So I would argue that it needs to be repealed.
Do you see anything that can reach similar goals to SESTA-FOSTA in a more constructive way, or is it just that this approach is harmful, we have to do away with it?
So there are actually a lot of other federal programs that would have been helpful that the administration has been cutting. Like, there was a program specifically for survivors of sex trafficking to get help finding housing and to get their criminal records expunged, because oftentimes they get picked up and charged with a crime as part of the rescue industry, I guess. So then they can't get homes because they have these things on their records. They have a hard time finding jobs. So they got rid of the program for expungements, and they got rid of a $13.5 million grant that was earmarked for survivors to get help with housing. So there are many sorts of programs that I think could help with this, but I don't believe that this administration will go that route. The most important thing, I think, is making sure that people have places off of the street to live, to rest, to work. Those are the ways that you combat this sort of thing, is that you make sure people are secure in their lives, and then they don't have to do the sort of... I think a lot of people don't understand that there is not a black and white distinction between victim and criminal when we talk about sex work, right? So you can't just look at somebody and tell what sort of situation they're in. Oftentimes, there are going to be other aspects of the work that are going to be criminalized. You know, the sort of people that traffic other people, often traffic guns, often traffic drugs, you know. And so you pull these people into this whole criminal world, and then it becomes very, very difficult for them to leave. And I think that a lot of people don't understand that if we took this seriously, we would be looking at things like decriminalization. Not legalization, that's different, but decriminalization of sex work, because then that would allow sex workers to report assaults to the police, for example. Or that would allow, like, a worker to say, hey, there's this guy trafficking people. But right now, that worker can't go to the police and say that because she'll be arrested, right? And so I think if people really want to address this problem, you have to bring the people with experience into the solution, right? Because their input is going to be more valuable than what somebody from the outside looking in is going to say, because so much of this takes place away from public eyes.
Stephanie Smith, thank you so much for talking with me.
Yeah, thank you.